happy Tuesday evening, everyone. This is Pam Stack. I'm your host for Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, I'm speaking to another debut novelist. The book is called Dominus, and it's a brilliant thriller set in behind the Vatican, inside the Vatican, but behind the scenes. I want to tell you a little bit about my guest, Tom Fox. His storytelling emerges from very many years in academia. He is a scholar who has worked on the history of the Christian church. He's a very respected authority on this subject, but recently he's turned his attention to exploring stories that can be drawn out of his work in the Christian church. It is my honor and a privilege to welcome Tom Fox to Authors on the Air. Good evening, Tom. Welcome to the radio. How are you this evening, sir?
Good evening to you as well, Pam. It's really lovely to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so honored that you took the time to be my guest this evening, especially to talk about Dominus, your thriller set in the Vatican. I have to say that when I received this book from your publisher, I went and looked at the jacket, and it told a little bit about you being a scholar on the Christian church. So the next day I picked up the book, which is something I don't normally do because I have such a long to-be-read list. I sat down and read this book in one sitting and could not put it down. Congratulations on a magnificent thriller.
Well, what a treat to hear you say that, Pam. I'm just delighted that it could capture you like that. And I know you read a lot of books for this program, and I'm delighted that it made such an impact on you.
It certainly did. I always say to my friends that I am a recovering Catholic, and that is not to cast aspersions on any particular church, but when you grow up in a very devout family and you surround yourself with the Catholic Church, sometimes as an adult you begin to question not only the dogma, but you know, you get to be an adult and you read about the church and all its machinations. I don't want to diminish in any way devout Catholics. I am so happy that people are confident in their religious choices. Does that make sense to you, Tom?
Of course. I mean, I think all of us at various times in our lives ask questions about things, and religion deals in very big things, and so the questions become equally big. And so I think it's a phenomenon that I know very well, that we really struggle to understand and deal with suspicion and concerns about the things going on, especially the things we don't see.
Yeah, it's hard. I know that faith is a big part of any religious doctrine, and I appreciate that. I would like to start, if you don't mind, asking you about your life in academia and how you chose to study the Christian church. Will you share, please?
Well, sure. I started out as a classicist, Pam, so studying, you know, ancient Roman religion and Greek religion, and was always fascinated by the whole phenomenon of belief and ritual and mythology and all of these things. And so it seemed very natural to just extend that period forward as one sort of tradition of world religions transformed into another. So it really captured me as a student and as a, you know, later on as a graduate student. To dive into these areas where so much is known, but so much is still a mystery, so much is still unknown. And that, to me, has always been a point of fascination, both as a scholar and as a, I suppose, as a storyteller as well. It's those areas where we think we know what happened, but we're not entirely sure. That's where a lot of fun mystery takes place.
I would imagine so. Tom, when you studied the Christian church and made this part of your academic career, did you look at other religions besides Catholicism? And did you deal strictly with the doctrine of it, or did you delve into the behind-the-scenes, don't know, drama of it maybe, or the suspicions, or, you know, whatever comes along with investigating church.
Well, absolutely. I have looked at lots of different world religions in the course of, you know, an academic career, not just with Christianity or Catholicism, but many different traditions from many different cultures. And of course, part of that is doctrine, beliefs, or the faith that people have, the dogmas that they subscribe to. But I think there's always a personal fascination with the apparatus of religion, you know, the structures, the different offices and rituals and people. To me, that's where the real intrigue of history lies. What do people actually do with themselves, setting up these religions, living them out, running them, being a part of them? That's really, to me, the area of intrigue.
When you, during your studies of particularly the Catholic Church, and I'm going to focus on that because your book is set in the Vatican, were you surprised at some of the things you learned?
Well, yes and no, Pam. I mean, yes, you always learn new things, and a lot of them were surprising. On the other hand, no, there's so much mythology built up in literature, in fiction, in storytelling, in movies about Catholicism and about the Vatican, that in some sense, you know, the only real surprise is that it's not this great den of intrigue necessarily that everyone thinks it is. That there is a sense of normalcy about the Vatican, you know, normal people doing normal things in a very unusual environment. But yes, there are always surprises to learn. You have a whole government, a whole political city-state that literally is behind closed walls, and much of what goes on there isn't really known to people until you can go and see it firsthand. So you're learning how technologically astute and advanced the Swiss Guard is, for example. That was a real surprise to me. I had always assumed that they were just nicely costumed gentlemen who stood in ceremonial posts. But to learn that this is a very elite secret service, in essence, and protective detail, with a lot of techno-savvy behind them, that was quite a surprise, you know.
During your career in academia and also for research for this book, were you able to go into places in the Vatican that normally the faithful or tourists are not allowed?
Yes, over the years I've been able to have some really wonderful access to Vatican City. When I was studying, I developed a very close friendship with a Jesuit. And the first time I ever went to Rome was as a tourist, you know, camera strapped on my neck and snapping pictures of all these places that I'd studied since I was a child. But the second time I went was with this Jesuit friend of mine. And that opened doors that I never could have walked through on my own. You know, going behind the scenes in St. Peter's, back into the sacristies where everyone prepares for the services, walking through the back corridors and the archives of the Vatican Library, of the Vatican Museums, and so on. So I feel really fortunate to have seen quite a lot of that secretive environment. Not so much secretive, but simply an environment that most people don't have any exposure to.
I have to tell you that many, many, many years ago, my brother and I experienced our first European trip. We're both from Miami, and we were walking in an opposite direction of a huge crowd in Rome, and we noticed nuns and priests and the faithful, and we said, "Where is everyone going?" And they said, "Well, the Pope will be doing a mass, an outdoor mass." And from that mass, which, by the way, was one of the things on my bucket list, which before they called them bucket lists, the mass, he said by the Pope, obviously, but we happened to meet a couple of the Swiss Guard who took us on a tour. Now, we were in our early 20s, and that was really something. We did not know how unusual that was to be allowed to go inside parts of the Vatican that the tourists did not go. And it was a stunning time for me. I have to tell you, it really made an impact. So I want to move a little bit forward. And, you know, you're kind of probably an old hat at going into the Vatican, not so when you're a young kid, you know, in your early 20s and having been raised in the church and all. But I want to move a little bit forward and talk about your book, Dominus. What made you decide to write a fiction book after all of your years studying in academia?
It's a great question.
Thank you.
I, for very many years, Pam, didn't read any fiction at all. I think this is a phenomenon that a lot of people who do masters and doctorates and so on fall into,
yes,
because you have to read,
yes,
so much scholarly literature, just a constant flow of it, that you just, without really noticing it, you gradually wean yourself off of fiction writing or reading. And I think it had probably been at least 10 years, if not 12 or more, where I hadn't even picked up a piece of fiction at all. And, you know, I owe a credit to Dan Brown, I have to say, because it was when his Da Vinci Code
right,
came out. It was the first piece of fiction that I heard being talked about in academic circles, because it was dealing with a subject matter, a time frame that I deal with, early Christianity and so on.
Sure.
And people were talking about this book often enough that I said, well, I should really just find out what it is. And I remember going into the bookshop and buying a copy and sitting down and reading it. And, you know, whatever one may think of that particular book, being infused with fiction again was just overwhelming. It was like I had been denied a certain degree of oxygen for so many years. And I loved it. It absolutely turned things around for me. And I have been reading back in the fiction world ever since. And I suppose after a few years, I said to myself, you know, I've always loved telling stories. I wonder if I could write one down. And so decided to give it a go.
How lovely for you. Tom, in your professional career in academia, are you a teaching professor?
Not at the moment. I recently retired from that. I have been, but I stepped aside from that. Retired sounds wrong. I'm not quite that old, but I moved on. I'm now a research professor.
You're doing other things. And where might
right,
one find you when you're working in your professorial duties?
Well, mostly over in England. I split my time largely between London and Los Angeles these days.
Mm-hmm.
But my doctoral work and master's work was done in Oxford, in central England, and I'm still
lovely,
there quite regularly.
Do you enjoy the teaching process?
I love it. There's nothing
really
quite like being with a group of people and getting them to not so much be interested, but realize that they just naturally are interested in something that they weren't aware was fascinating before. There's nothing quite like that, I have to say.
Will you go back to Oxford or perhaps someplace else and maybe consider teaching creative writing and fiction?
You know, I have already been asked to do a course or two on that. I don't know, Pam. It's all things are possible, let's put it that way. I love teaching, and I don't suppose it matters much what one is teaching. But yeah, it might be fun. But though I'm still a learner in this, you know, in the academic world, one normally doesn't start teaching until you've been doing something for quite a long time. And so maybe I'm not yet qualified. I don't know.
Well, one doesn't know. But I want to say the reviews on your book have been outstanding. The reviewers everywhere, and I know the book just released on today is your release day. Yes, so it's just
that's
releasing.
Right, here in the U.S.
And mm-hmm, and thank you so much for being here on release day. But here, it's an interesting thing. I read this from For the Love of Books, which is a very well-known review site, and they said head and shoulders above the usual church-themed thrillers with an intelligent plot and thoughtful characters. And then it goes on and on and on to talk about what a lovely book this is. For our listeners, will you please talk about Dominus and give a little synopsis of the story? Actually, you can give a long synopsis if you care to.
Well, I'm happy to, Pam, of course.
Please.
You know, Dominus started for me with an image, a kind of scene that formed in my head that became the opening sequence of the book, the opening chapters, which was really a vision of a man walking into St. Peter's Basilica in Rome during a pontifical mass celebrated by the Pope. And a figure walks in who is just an ordinary man in blue jeans and a normal shirt, who starts walking down the central aisle. And as he walks down the aisle, for reasons that they don't really comprehend, everyone starts to go silent at his presence, starts to stare at him. As he approaches the front of the long aisle in this crowded basilica, the Swiss guard themselves let him through their ranks. The security doesn't stop him. And in an unheard of way, he simply walks right up to the altar where the Pope is celebrating. And they have a dialogue together. And then in the presence of thousands of people with cameras and everything else, this unassuming, ordinary-looking man appears to heal the Pope of a lifelong crippling ailment before everyone's eyes, and then quietly sits down. That was the image for me that really started the whole story, and then the questions that emerge out of it. How would people react if this happened? You know, this is a part of the world, at the center of one of the biggest world religions. And if something that seemed like an actual miracle took place before everyone's eyes, how would humanity react? Would it be with faith and hope and joy, or would it be with suspicion and anger and deviousness? And as I think the book makes very clear early on, I think both of these things would probably take place.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to explore that. You know, faith and belief are very interesting things, interesting phenomena. We are, as a people, just as suspicious as we are believing, and anxious to see good in the world, but also very attuned to seeing evil in it. And I thought that this would make for a really exciting, tense story. So that's where the idea for Dominus was born, Pam.
You know, Tom, I absolutely can imagine you sitting there saying, what if? What if? And it's such a perfect opening for this book. And I immediately felt exactly as you described. How can this be that this man who was this Pope who was born with this crippling disease, who's never walked a day in his life, and yet some guy walks in and immediately the Pope is healed and the Swiss guard are on their knees and quiet. It just was mind-boggling to me. You and I talked a little bit before we came on live on this broadcast. We talked about some authors who your book is being compared to. You mentioned Dan Brown, but we also talked about Simon Toyne. I'm sure you read his first trilogy. Simon is a dear friend of mine, and actually his trilogy won Book of the Year a few years ago when it came out. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about being compared to Dan Brown? Simon Toyne?
Well, you know, being compared to Dan Brown is, I'm afraid, something that, for better or worse, anyone who writes in this genre is going to face for many years to come, I think. He's become the kind of figurehead name of the genre. And, you know, I've enjoyed his books. I think they're very different from mine, writing style. But I certainly have enjoyed them. But to me, the real honor is to be compared to Simon Toyne, who I don't know personally, but whose writing I have always loved. I remember reading Sanctus when it first came out and being absolutely thrilled with it. And then The Tower, of course. And when The Key came out, I remember the subtitle, I think, to The Key was The Truth Cannot Wait. And I remember saying, well, I cannot wait. You know, I want to read this immediately.
I agree with
readers
you.
Are finding some comparison there, then I'm absolutely honored.
Yes, I think you're right. Dan Brown wrote a very different kind of a story, not so much in a spiritual sense, but I don't mean that to say that it is a religious treatise on anything. It's a spiritual treatise. It is a work of fiction, but brilliantly unwound. You mentioned to me earlier that you have now a novella that is a prequel, and then you have one that is a sequel to Dominus. And I said to you, I will go and harass your publicist to the end of his days if I don't get to read those books. Will you tell me first about the prequel, Tom?
Yes. You know, these two stories, which are titled Genesis and Exodus, respectively,
yes,
are these two novellae. So they're not short stories. They're full-on stories, but
right,
obviously shorter than a novel. They were the brainchild, in a sense, of Emily Griffiths, who's the person who took me on at Headline in the UK to get all of this started. And she said, you know, for a story like Dominus, something to lead into it could really be a treat. And that was,
yes,
the impetus for me to sit down and write Genesis, which is a way of being introduced to the characters who are in Dominus, as well as some of the background story to the plot that Dominus exposes. But it's its own story in its own right, and like Dominus, I wanted to have it begin in a very captivating way. So Genesis,
yes,
begins with a devout young woman walking into Santa Maria Church, one of my favorite churches in Rome, to meet an elderly priest. And the elderly priest pulls out a gun and starts shooting at her. And the novella progresses trying to figure out what is happening, that this sweet elderly priest is being driven to this act. And it's a very fast-paced story that tries to answer that question. And I think that readers have really enjoyed it as a sort of foretaste of what comes in Dominus.
I love that. And so Exodus is the sequel, and that story is about what?
Right. Exodus takes place a couple of months after the conclusion of Dominus. And it begins with a dream that Alexander, one of the two lead characters,
yes,
in Dominus,
yeah,
has, a dream of a very strange, disjointed, murderous event taking place. And as he wakes up, he receives a phone call to go into the Vatican Museum, in particular to the Sistine Chapel, where he starts discovering that the elements of his dream are reality, that these things are actually occurring around him. And he tries to come to grips with discovering what is really going on. How is it that he seems to know from his sleep what is happening and what will happen around him in the aftermath of the conclusion of Dominus? I don't want to say too much about it because the conclusion of Dominus is quite a cliffhanger. Yes.
Absolutely, it really is. Gabriella be joining Alexander.
Gabriella is she's the main character in Genesis, and
yes,
she certainly also figures into Exodus as well. Though for each of the shorter works, I chose to focus in on one of them a little more. So Genesis is kind of Gabriella's mainstay, and Exodus is a bit more with Alexander. But, you know, they're a duo, so they come together.
Absolutely. So let me ask you a few things, and let's set aside the trilogy for right now, because it is indeed a trilogy, regardless of how many words. Are you enjoying fiction writing?
I absolutely love it, Pam. It's a treat to be able to tell stories as I want them to be told. It's just an utter delight. You know, I said to my literary agent, Luigi Bonomi in London, when I first started in on this, I said, I almost feel like I'm cheating. You know, as an academic, you're never allowed to make things up.
Sure.
But now I can make up whatever I want. I can create stories, create scenarios. I can twist reality around. And it's an absolute playtime. I'm like a kid in a candy shop with it.
I love that. What is the most difficult part of writing fiction for you, Tom?
The difficult part of writing fiction, I think simply trying to weave the stories together in a way that lets them be as complex as I like them to be,
yeah,
while still having that punch and the pace that I enjoy reading in other books. I like stories that don't just have one sort of storyline going through, but three,
yes,
or four or five that weave together So it's difficult, but that's also probably what I enjoy the most about it, is crafting these interwoven threads until finally at some point they all form this knot together and you see how each piece connects to the others. It's a real challenge, but it's fun. It's great fun.
How lovely. I want to remind everyone that I am speaking to author Tom Fox about Dominus, his full-length novel, which is a thriller based at the Vatican. If you'd like to say hello to Tom Fox, please give us a call at 347-633-9609. The first person to call is going to get a book by Tom. So, Tom, you said you were working on another book. This will be a whole new story, or this will be a continuation? Tell me what's on your upcoming agenda as a fiction writer.
Well, yes, I'm really pleased and excited about it, that I've just worked out the details and have started actually into the writing now for the next novel, which is going to be with different characters. So it's not going to be a continuation of the series, though.
Okay.
I might bring them back at another time. I'm certainly already being asked when the next Gabriella and Alexander book is going to come out. But I think we thought, the publisher and myself thought, that it would be fun to do something a little different for the next book. And so it's going to, again, be set in Rome, and certainly have parts of it set in the Vatican. But it will be a very different sort of plot, very different sort of characters, but within the same genre. So I think readers who have enjoyed Dominus will be automatically drawn towards this kind of story.
How lovely. I want to say that in Dominus, the head of the Swiss Guard, who I thought was a fascinating character, I want you to know that when I was reading, I thought, if anyone picks us apart, maybe it's going to be him. And I don't want to give any more of that away, but your characters were so lovely and fully fleshed out. They were whole, real people. Particularly Alexander, because of his background, who he was before and who he is now, and his crisis of conscience that he has. I'm so looking forward to your next book. What do you have a working title right now, or are you still writing?
Well, I'm just beginning writing, but yes, we do have a working title, which I haven't shared with anyone, so I might as well share it with you and your 3 million listeners, Pam.
Thank you so much, Tom.
At least for the moment, and of course these things can sometimes change, but for the moment it's called The Seventh Commandment. It, as I say, it's also going to be staged in Rome, but a very different type of plot. There's going to be a discovery of a certain artifact in the city that sets a few things in motion. And again, we're going to be faced with questions of what is real and what is fake, what is a myth, what is truth, how far are secrets involved and how far is simple manipulation involved. So I'm very excited. I've drafted out the novel from beginning to end, and I think it's going to be a fun one, Pam.
Tom, when you wrote Dominus, did you draft that book also?
Yes, only in the sense that I had a very concrete beginning I wanted to work with, and I had two endings, I have to say, the one that's in the book and a different one, because I wasn't entirely certain until I started getting into the book and the characters' heads and the way things came together, how I wanted to tie the knots together at the end. And I had two different possibilities, and I did draft them both out, but it became very clear by the time I got there that the one ending was the right one, and that's the one we put into the book. And I'm very happy that we did, because it seems to be an ending that a lot of people find surprising, but very satisfying.
It was a very stunning denouement to your book. I so enjoyed it, and as I said, I read it in one sitting because I could not put the book down. I could not. I did not want to put it down either. Let me ask you a little bit about your writing process. Did you know instinctively, because of all your work in academia and the professional writings that you've done, how to write a fiction novel, Tom? The actual craft of putting together a fiction novel such as this?
I think, if anything, Pam, being an academic is a hindrance to writing a novel. You know, the type of writing that we have to do in the scholarly world, pace and action, it hath not, I think we might say.
Sure.
You know, there's this focus on hyper-accuracy and factual detail,
yes,
and all of this, which other scholars find really engaging and absolutely no one else does, for very good reason. So I think if I had only been an academic, I probably would have written a dreadful, boring book that I would have thought was brilliant and no one else would have ever seen, because it would have stayed in my computer forever. No, I think that the preparation for writing fiction, it came through reading and comes through reading. One
yes.
of the best bits of advice I ever received was, if you want to write, read.
You must read,
and,
yes.
You know,
tell
I've learned through...
You.
Oh,
tell me. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to
interrupt. No, no.
Go ahead.
No, it's all right. I was just going to say, you know, I've learned by reading what sort of things drive me, what sort of style I like, what sort of pace I
yes.
like, even down to what sort of chapters I like. And so I tried to write a book that fulfilled my own criteria for, you know, if I picked this up off the shelf, would I enjoy reading it?
Yeah.
And followed that as a test. And then, of course, remained open to criticism, feedback, suggestions from some very talented friends and collaborators later on in the process.
Would you please take me back to a young Tom Fox and tell me, were you surrounded by books? Did you read fiction, or did you read nonfiction, or a little of both?
It was both. It was absolutely everything. Books were everywhere. I remember being in primary school, and one of my earliest memories, I don't remember what year of school I was in, but I was very little. We were organized by our reading abilities into different colored dots, green dots, red dots, and the top dot was blue. And this determined which sort of little reading group you went off into during story time. And I remember the thrill I had on receiving a blue dot, because we got to read bigger books and longer stories. So I've always been a bibliophile since my very youngest years, and that's never gone away, though it's ebbed and flowed in terms of what I read.
I'm sure. Who was the driving factor for your love of reading when you were a child?
Well, I think everyone in my family were avid readers, so I can't give any sort of distinction to any one of them more than the others. It was an influence for all of us. But I remember having a teacher, you know, the influence of teachers is quite profound. I remember a teacher very vividly who would, not only would she read us stories as little children, but she imbued in us, it's important to hear stories. Listening to stories is a part of being a human being. And I remember that so vividly. And I shared that with my own students, with friends, that you know, we are storytellers as creatures. One of the unique traits of the human animal is that we tell stories to each other. And that's something to be cherished.
When you were writing your book, speaking of that, were there times when you read your own story out loud?
Yes, constantly.
Tell me about that. I want to know what that experience is like, because I have to tell you, there were parts of this book, and actually, I'm so bad about this, but I have sticky notes all through your book of parts that I wanted to read over and over again. Will you please tell me how and why you decided to read out loud?
Well, I think fundamentally we hear stories. You know, reading is a fairly modern phenomenon. Much as you love it and I love it, for most of human history, most people couldn't read and there wasn't anything to read. I mean, the written books were extremely rare. and most people couldn't have read them if they had one. So for thousands of years, generations and cultures, we have heard stories. And
yes,
that's, to me, the natural way that a story gets encountered is by hearing it. So I, when I write, I take these very long walks, Pam. I'm an avid walker. And when I'm about to write something, what I'll normally go is take a long walk and write it out loud. I'll simply talk to myself and tell the story to the air as I walk and listen to how it sounds. And if I like what
Wonderful.
I'm hearing, then I'll go back home and I'll try to write it down. But to me, that's, it's just a very natural way of writing. When I sit down and try to compose words without that sort of hearing, it always comes out a little forced, and I find myself going back and rewriting it later on.
Interesting, because it does touch different parts of your brain. What you read, what you see as far as a visual or a graphic, plus what you hear. So you are engaged on several different levels. And I truly believe, I may be wrong, but I truly believe people absorb information in all these different ways. So mm-hmm. as a writer, it makes sense to me that you are touching on all these things yourself. And
right.
I also wonder, when you're talking to yourself, do you listen to your dialogue to say, I wonder if this sounds real? Does it sound authentic?
Yeah, absolutely. And oftentimes, you know, I'll write something, a dialogue between two characters. This often happened with Gabriella and Alexander,
the
two protagonists.
Yes.
And, you know, I would sit and write a dialogue between them because they have a lot of very engaged back and forth in this book. And there's
yes,
a lot of different factors, you know, faith and doubts. There's a little romance there. There's a little antagonism. And often I would write a dialogue between them that I was very satisfied with. And then I would read it out to myself and say, they would never talk like that. Gabriella doesn't sound like that. So she doesn't use those words. Something that really wouldn't occur until I tried to actually say it aloud. And, you know, you get the tone of voice and the way words play off of each other, which you don't always get just reading them off the page.
Tom, when you were writing this book, obviously there are a lot of questions that readers are going to ask themselves about this particular book, about they're going to question their faith, they're going to question the dogma, as we talked about, they're going to question religion. Was it your intention to not only create just a lovely fiction story and a book for people to enjoy, but also to ask themselves personal questions?
I think it was, Pam, to a certain degree. I mean, you know, I didn't set out to write a religious book, and I don't think it is a religious book, as you
no,
said already.
Right.
I think what it does is picks up religion, which is one of the most influential forces in modern culture, whatever one may think about it. You know, one can be entirely against religion, and it still is a powerful force in their morality, their ideology, etc. And I wanted to play with that. And I suppose my only real sort of goal when I set out was I didn't want to write another book where organized religion is just the big bad guy in the corner. This is kind of a trope in this genre that,
yes,
you know, behind the walls of the Vatican, everyone is evil, everyone is sinister. Well, in Dominus, there are plenty of evil, sinister people behind those walls. But there's also good, wonderful people there.
Yes.
And people who genuinely believe in what they've given their lives to, as well as people who are simply using it for their own ends. And I wanted to engage people with that complexity and, you know, ask questions about how we ourselves approach these things. How would we respond if we saw something like this took place? You know, would it bring
yes.
out the good in us, the bad, the suspicion, the fear? I don't know. Probably all of those things.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let me ask you a question. As a scholar, what do you think is importance or unimportance of fiction and culture today? Where does fiction stand in modern society?
Well, I find that there's a kind of split between society at large and then the intellectual strand of society. Within the scholarly world, by and large, fiction is really looked down upon as mm-hmm. really an unessential and sometimes even a really rudimentary enterprise. You know, to be a scholar and to be discovered as writing a work of fiction is a great scandal.
Really?
And that, I think, is an absolute pity. And I don't find that in the populace at large. I mean, people love stories. Perhaps
sure.
things like cinema and television have become the main conduits for them. But at least there is creative storytelling, some very good creative storytelling happening
Absolutely.
There. I personally think, Pam, that you know, fiction is what gets your imagination involved in your day-to-day life.
Yes.
We seem to live in a world where everything becomes so factual, so analytical, and very
yes.
dehumanizing.
Right.
We are, as I said before, we're storytellers, and if we don't do that, if we don't tell stories and listen to stories, we become less than what we ought to be. And that's a very sad thing.
I agree with you. May I ask, and you're free not to answer this question if you don't wish, but your fellow academics, what did they think when they found out you were writing fiction?
Well, I mean, those that know, and not a lot of them do, but those that know, there have been a mixed reaction. I mean, some said, well, that's interesting, and when you're done doing that, you know, come back to the real world.
And really?
Others, yes. What a bizarre reaction, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I have to tell you, it's a very snobbish reaction, if I can say that. And I don't, I'm not judging whether it's over in the UK or in the States, but I would imagine that, and I think it's boorish and snobbish because that's too bad. But you had colleagues who were very supportive of you, didn't you?
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. And this, I think, goes to show that whatever the professional apparatus may say about something, it's like theater. There's this sort of assumption that you have to like non-musical theater, and musical theater is just the boorish sort of bourgeoisie thing. Fantastic. Yeah. It's absolutely lovely, and the very people who say that in their reviews still go and see Wicked and Phantom of the Opera and love every
yes,
minute.
Yes, they
of them.
Do. Absolutely.
And I
agree with you 100%. I'm so glad that you had support from your friends, but also from your colleagues too. Tom, will you continue to write fiction, do you think?
Well, as long as they'll let me, yes, absolutely. As long as people want to read it and publishers want to publish it, I have found a real joy in this that was missing in my work for a long time. The art of the story. And also, I think that you can touch on very meaningful things sometimes through fiction in a way that you can't. I mean, if I had written a monograph on questions of doubt and manipulation and religious belief, even had I done it very well, I don't know if it would have the same power to actually affect a person as a story
yes.
like Dominus
does. I agree. Well,
so
it certainly
I think
affected
work.
Me. It certainly affected me. It made me think an awful lot. Your protagonists are folks who have just diametrically opposite experiences with their faith. And I saw a little bit of myself in both. And so I have to thank you for that, because this story of yours has stayed in my mind. And that, to me, is a sign of a great book, and I thank you for that.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's a treat to hear you say these things, Pam, because
yes.
you know, so often a fiction writer just doesn't hear that much. We get reviews online that are little blurbs here and there, but to actually
sure.
hear a person be affected by it, it's immensely gratifying.
Oh, it was just lovely, and it was so well written, and to tell you, I as I said to you before we came on the air, I read the book in one sitting. I did that a couple Sundays ago when your publisher sent me the book, and I just walked away saying, wow, what a great book. I cannot thank you enough for taking time out of your schedule to come and talk to me, Tom, about Dominus. Will you please come back when your next book is written?
Well, I mean, I've received such a wonderful treatment here, Pam. How could I possibly say no? Of course
I will.
You're
so kind. You're so kind. Please tell us where we can find you. I know that your social media exposure is very limited, but I love your Twitter feed. Will you please share your Twitter information with our listeners?
Yes, I'm new to Twitter. I got signed up a few weeks ago, and I'm gradually figuring out just what on earth it is. My Twitter name or handle or whatever it's called is at ReallyTomFox.
There are so many Tom Foxes on Twitter, and when you put it there, I just had to laugh. I thought, here is this scholar, this academician, who's putting really Tom Fox. I got the biggest out of it. So,
are so many Tom Foxes, and some of them
are big
names. Apparently, a big footballer back in Aston Villa that a lot of people are upset with. So I was getting quite a lot of very angry messages in Twitter until people realized that I was not this football manager.
Okay. There you go.
But I do love interacting with people on Twitter. It's been quite a lot of fun, and hopefully I'll be hearing from some of your listeners as well.
I hope you will as well. And I hope that soon you put up a Facebook page or whatever it is that you feel compelled to do, because Tom, your book is brilliant. And if I may say, and I'm saying this out loud, my listeners know that at the end of every year, there is a Authors on the Air Book of the Year. I want to tell you, your book is on the short list now.
Oh, that's wonderful news. What a surprise. What a shock.
Yes.
Oh, I'm giddy. Well, that's lovely.
Good. You and I will be in touch through your publisher, obviously. Please come back anytime. And thank you so much for spending so much time with me tonight. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed our conversation.
Well, it's been lovely getting to know you. And let me just also return the thanks by saying thank you for the work you do with the radio program. Anything that can be done to get people reading. And, you know, for me, a brand new author, first novel, this is a real treat and a privilege. So I look forward to being introduced to other writers by you.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you what, the next time you come on, how about if we get Mr. Simon Toyne to come on too, and you guys will have a chat together, and I'll just fade into the background and you can discuss fiction writing. Would that be okay?
That would be absolutely superb. So I might just grovel for an hour, so I'm not sure that would really please
your
listeners.
Don't do that to Simon. He's a great guy, but don't do that. I don't want his head swollen so I can't get him back on the show. He's a lovely fellow,
right.
And I hope that we have a chance to meet in person, Tom. Thank you again for being my guest, and have a great evening. What a wonderful book, Dominus. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Good night.
Good night.
And folks, that's my interview tonight with the wonderful Tom Fox, whose book Dominus is on my shortlist for Book of the Year. Tomorrow night, I'm bringing you another debut novelist, Alex Gilley. His book, Devil's Harbor, is a thriller. He's going to be live from Sydney. So he'll be actually interviewing on Thursday morning his time and Wednesday night mine. Have a great evening. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.